Hello, this is Melissa and Darren, and this is our first recording, the first meeting on the first section that we assigned on Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope. So welcome everybody who is listening to this, and hello, Darren.
Hi. Hi, Melissa. Hi, everyone. This is the beginning and the start of something quite special, I think, but if you've read as far as we have, and you were thinking about doing what Melissa and I are about to do, I think you'd realize it's quite an ask, so we hope we can justify your time.
So we've been back and forth on this daunting task, because when we said, oh, let's have a book club, and we decided to read, you know, this more than 1,300-page book, as big a task as that was to give ourselves a year, it didn't seem that much. But it's in breaking it down and conveying some of the bigger ideas that it becomes a daunting task. And we still are hopeful that in future recordings, some of you will want to actually participate in the conversation. And nobody stepped forward so far to do that, but we're hopeful that that'll happen. So we call this a work in progress. We're going to do our best to give you what we think are the high points of this first segment. And then I also want to say before we launch into it that it's good to see that some people have subscribed to the Telegram site. Darren, do you have that address memorized that you can?
Well, I could read it out.
Yes, or spell it out.
All right. It's all lowercase, and it's t.me/ Cutting Through the Matrix Book Club. All one word. And okay. That's it.
All right. So it's pretty simple. I'm not sure if in your browser you have to type in HTTPS or if you're on a different device. All you need is the t.me/ Cutting Through the Matrix Book Club. But people are subscribing and they're starting to even record comments, which is a nice little feature. You can just hit the record button and have 2 or 3 minutes of audio. You could ask questions. You can leave a comment. So I think this is good. And then we will also be putting this out on the other Cutting Through the Matrix site.
Okay, so the first link that I spelt out will take you. You could put it into your browser. And then if you've got Telegram, it'll link across to your Telegram app.
Great. So we're seeing that people are making comments, they're subscribing, and that is good because this will be the primary hub for group interaction. So without further ado, let us dive into the book.
Are you going to start?
I may start just by giving some ideas about studying history. And one of them was a comment that Alan Watt used to make about how important it was to be able to actually, to the best of your ability, put yourself in the time and the place of the period that you're learning about, because it's difficult from a remove of 100 or 1,000 years, you will automatically see things through the lens of your own understanding and your own time, your own perceptions. And he said it really is an art to be able to just move across that time and space and let go of all of your prejudices and your ideas about things. And one of the challenging things about Carol Quigley and that approach to studying history is that his writing is excellent, but it does not evoke the time and the place. It's very fact-based. Every sentence that he writes is dense with information, and so then you have a dense paragraph and a dense page, and this is part of the task of putting it across, is that in this first roughly 100 pages, there is so much information. But I go back again to what Alan said is, you know, step back again, that bird's eye view, and think, well, what would it have been like to be alive under those circumstances at that time? And you start to get a different picture of what you're looking at.
Yeah, Melissa, when I've been going through these differences in the cultural evolutions of civilizations and the way that he describes the changes in a society from an expansion to a decline, and he goes into a little bit more detail about how that happens, if you think back to your own past 20, 30 years of your life, you can get an inkling, some examples of what you've seen in countries that have been hit by communism and that have broken out of communism. You can see how certain societies in the East are expanding now with a very young population. You can also see how, especially if you take into the last 3-4 years from the COVID, what would you call it, an event, a marketing event. The part that stands out to me, I wanted to put this across because it's been bothering me. When I read Quigley's book, I get the impression that he's trying to pass off a lot of the stuff as being happenstance and coincidence, and this is just the way things evolve.
Yes.
And I'm not buying it. I think he wants people to have that impression, so I don't think he's necessarily being as honest as he could. I think he's keeping a little secret, because when you delve into the steps that he takes you through for the various changes in Western civilization or the different periods of time, if you've been paying attention to your own life and if you know how things are managed, you can see how it's quite easy to take people through cycles. I think you can manufacture them quite easily. And a part that jumped out to me was the Russian part towards the end of the reading. When he was describing the evolution or the changes occurring within the Russian culture and their civilization up to recent times, it reads like a young person entering the troubled teenage years. In my mind, I see Russia as a young, troubled person, completely confused and very vulnerable to propaganda and changes of ideas, especially with those extremes in views. And the more I read that chapter about Russia, I couldn't help thinking, this is America right now. We're seeing all these things being applied to a very troubled America. The woke, the irrationality, the extremes and polarized views.
Mm-hmm.
I think we can take a lot of that final chapter. I think we'll speak a lot to what people are experiencing in the West now. It's almost like Germany and what happened in Russia are prequels to what is happening in the West.
I think that's a very good point. And I also, before we move away from that, I wanted to add to what you said about Quigley's presentation. It's very much the accidental view of history. So even though this book is famous in what you might call, and I say wrongly, conspiracy circles, by saying that there is an Anglo-American establishment, there have been plans, there is a movement towards this kind of coordination. As much as he acknowledges that, he is at the same time presenting historical events and cycles from the accidental view of history. So I have to, off the bat, disagree. And also, just in terms of whatever you read, try to read it not only with the view of what the time was like then, but also of things that you know from other sources, and then piece it together. So for example, for me, I think Quigley's description, he says that Western civilization is really springs from Christianity. But then he goes on to give his assertion of what Christianity was in the early days, and there are a lot of ways in which I disagree with his characterization of what Christianity was then, particularly as he's contrasting it with the Orthodox Christianity of Russia. And that plays into, because he says, I think that'll just take me, I may skip over a little part and go into a place we can jump back there, but this is in the section called Europe's Shift to the 20th Century. And he describes something, and again, this initially comes out of the birth of Christianity, but here we are in his writing in the 19th century. He said, while Europe's traits were diffusing outward to the non-European world, Europe was also undergoing profound changes and facing difficult choices at home. These choices were associated with drastic changes, in some cases, we might say reversals of Europe's point of view. These changes may be examined under eight headings. The 19th century was marked by 1, belief in the innate goodness of man. 2, secularism. 3, belief in progress. 4, liberalism. 5, capitalism. 6, faith in science. 7, democracy. And 8, nationalism. And then he talks about how these were very 19th century values that held up until 1914. And I wanted to say that just as reading and understanding this book in 2024 requires some thinking outside the box, it is very difficult in the time you live to understand that the great population of people, especially people who had access to learning or books or whatever, thought very differently only 100 years before. Because what he's describing in the 19th century, one, if you believe in the innate goodness of man, then what you don't believe in is Orthodox Christianity, which is founded on the fallen nature of man. What he's describing in the 19th century is a complete move away from a religious underpinning of civilization into a secular underpinning. And then he talks about that reverting back to that in 1914, at the end of World War I, when people's view of the world and their faith in mankind was so shattered. And I think that these are important points because you need to see the world through the eyes in the 19th century, completely secular, whereas 200 years before, the learned man would not have been secularized in his worldview.
Okay, sorry, there's been a bit of latency, so I wasn't too sure if I'd lost you completely or not.
Okay, that's what we'll add is that Darren is in, they're really rolling blackouts. What do they call that? What's the euphemistic term?
They call it load shedding, and it really tends to happen at the wrong time. Even though I've got what looks like a full internet connection, I think there's just latency going back to the tower. So it might be fast between devices, but I think coming from the originating tower, it's a bit of a slowdown there. There might be a little bit of trouble with the internet connection.
Okay. Well, we'll try. Well, so what I was saying, I was just concluding, taking a highlight from his section on Europe's shift to the 20th century and the belief in the innate goodness of man. And this concept of Quigley's will come up again in this first 100 pages of big shifts, or as he calls it, even reversals in the way that people viewed the world around them. And so I think we are in 2024 also in a very different way of viewing man and viewing society. So I think it's kind of a key concept. But that being said, do you want to jump back to closer to the beginning?
I'm going to go back to the beginning a little.
Okay.
Getting back to 2024, it's an age of pessimism. And he starts off with the very first paragraph. He starts off saying, never before have the philosophers questioned with such dolorous tones and rephrased their question in such despairing words, can man survive? And that's all we hear at the moment. It's the end of the world. The earth is dying. Everything's polluted. There is some big shift and some big change in the air. And so we are on the cusp of a new age. They call it the New World Order. So he's taking us through a series of what he makes out to be natural, cultural, or civilization cycles. And I think it's good of us to question the coincidental approach he takes, even though he describes it in great detail. I think there's far more control to how civilization is taken through their worldview. If we take a look at the modern society, we see the influence of technology and how easy it is to put messaging out into the public mind to control your perception of where the world is. The zeitgeist can be completely fictitious nowadays. Mm-hmm. We can have even people who are quite awake to the world can still, without really realizing it, have an underpinning of a zeitgeist. And you've got to tell yourself just how much of this is true, because 90% of the fear-mongering is, it's plausible, but it doesn't ever happen. You know, and I just wanted to get back to something like the Cold War. We have been petrified of nuclear warfare since the 50s. Has there ever been anything like it? No. Now they're scaring us with pandemics. We didn't really have one, but the fear is there of an even worse one coming. Cyber attack, the whole thing. But before the advent of technology, we mustn't forget that people were close-knit communities that used to go to church. And just because they didn't have instant technology, they were given a story. They were given perceptions of what the zeitgeist should be in their minds. And the church did a big spin on people's heads about where people stood in relation to others, to their betters, to their deity. And so when we go through Carol Quigley's book, even though he does it in a dry sort of way, just bear in mind that human beings haven't really changed that much. Take a look around you at the people in your world with all the different personalities, the different types of, the characters who are, you could say, more tricky, more cunning, all the way through to the most innocent and good-natured people. Human beings are the same, I think, throughout time. But you can program a human brain, you can create a culture, and you can create a universal viewpoint if you have all the levers of what you can feed the public mind. So I want to push back against what Carol Crookley says to a degree. I think when we go through the book, I'd like the person who's thinking about it to think about what he's seen in the last 5 years. If the COVID situation woke you up, or it was 9/11, and you saw the fingers, you saw the strings, you know, you saw the invisible hand pulling the strings, you realized that there was coercion. And before you might have realized there was coercion, you were quite happy in your life, just floating along, and things just happened. And to people reading this book who have that mindset, this book might be quite natural for them to follow along with Carol Quigley and not think any deeper. But Carol Quigley was part of the crowd, elite, those ones who created viewpoints for the public, who were behind the big movements in history. And they would like nothing more for you to believe that these are just natural cycles that follow every 150 years or whatever it is. So I just, if the reader can just bear that in mind as they pass through this material, I think you'll see the guiding hand. It's not directly mentioned in the book, but you'll see a guiding hand if you have that perspective that I'm trying to get across here. So, Melissa, should we get into the, just follow through the chapter and...
Yes, I wanted to, I mean, I think that's a good setup, but I wanted to go towards the very beginning where in this chart, Quigley breaks down past and present civilizations, the dates of them, and then what he calls the universal empire. See, the first segment of the book, he is talking about the... what he calls the kind of mysterious way in which a civilization just springs up. Then it goes through what he calls an age of expansion and then moves into the age of conflict. And, you know, he says that most civilizations end up in the age of empire, but the age of conflict would be imperialist wars or forever wars. But what he's got here...
I am sorry, Melissa, but a generator has just been started.
Okay, that's all right. As long as we know
we should we stop and pause, or how do you? Is it? Can you still hear me? All right.
I can hear you. I think as long as people understand that there's a noise there that we won't be able to take out, and that's the generator, they'll know that's the generator. So, all right. So he talks about these civilizations, and then he makes the point here. He said of approximately 20 civilizations which have existed in all of human history, we've listed 16. Of the 16, 12, possibly 14 are already dead or dying. Six have been destroyed by Europeans bearing the culture of Western civilization. And he lists those that have been destroyed by Western civilization. That's the Andean, the Mayan, the Hindu, Chinese, Japanese, Islamic. And then he leaves us with two existing civilizations. And I think when I first read through this, I'm not sure how much that jumped out at me, but by the time I got to the end and he had covered Russia and I was thinking about the distinctions that he was making between Russian civilization, what he calls Orthodox civilization, and Western civilization, it really struck me because I've been so accustomed to, in a way, brushing off so much of the relentless propaganda that we get about the big bad bear and Russia is behind everything and it's Russiagate. Yeah. It's Russia, Russia, Russia. Mm. But I got outside of my own cynicism about that kind of propaganda. And I thought, this book was written in 1966. So we're at a remove of what is that? We're a long distance from this, and yet I believe that we are still at a point where these two civilizations are vying for supremacy, and it is yet to be seen if either one of them will be allowed to survive, or if what we are going into, if what we're living through right now is what Quigley called the birth pangs of a new civilization, we don't see where it's springing up. It's too close to us. It's too difficult to pull that out with the information that we have. But what is clear, I think, is that we are in a clash of civilizations that is underpinning everything that we live through. Two very different mindsets, if you will.
With the Western civilization, Quigley mentions, you know, from round about, I think he mentioned 1890 till about 1910, it's gone into the age of conflict. And then he went on to say round about from 1920 on, you know, the age of conflict in the West has been confirmed. And he said, well, it looks like if the age of conflict had to continue, you'd end up with an America becoming the new core of an age of empire. He mentioned towards the end of the one segment that will Western civilization be able to survive the age of conflict and move into a fourth age of expansion?
Yes, I don't have that marked. Yeah, I don't have that marked, but I do remember reading that, yes.
And I thought that's quite interesting because, you know, there's been a few books out there speaking about the fourth, the next move on to a new, expanded, brave new start. And I just found it interesting that he mentioned fourth because, you know, we've got the fourth industrial revolution being rammed down our throats.
Mm-hmm.
And if you listen carefully to what the fourth industrial revolution is all about, it is a new expansion. It is the breaking up of the old. You can see they're trying to destroy the old,
mm-hmm.
and they could very well finalize that destruction with severe conflict.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at what all the points, I think what there were four main points that describe, that stand out in the age of conflict, you have irrationality being one. I think people rush to religion. I don't know where those four points are. It's really hard to find with a little Kindle. All those four points are showing their face right now and for the last 20 years. And it ties in particularly with what Yuri Bezmenov described, you know, when they demoralize and they go through those four stages. And we are at the pinnacle of a new age. We're seeing all the signs of irrationality where otherworldly things – interesting, one of the four points of the age of conflict was that there are otherworldly sources for our problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't help thinking, well, you know, they keep running UFOs down our throats too. All we hear about are, you know, otherworldly things. And if you watch TV and you watch YouTube, it's just endless – otherworldly things. It's like the foundations of the earlier aspects of the Western civilization that we know in the mid-1800s, where people were more secular and more materialistic, and how it switches across to the irrational, where people now have an increased, dependence upon or a seeking a refuge in faith. It's all happening, just as he described. It looks like what's happening now with Klaus Schwab and his crowd, it's answered the question that quickly has posed at the end of this chapter, which way will Western civilization go? And I think it's going to go the way that they want it. It's going to go into another big age of expansion.
I found something that plays in with – this is not exactly – I don't think what you were looking for, but it does say, by 1930, it was clear that Western civilization was again in an age of conflict. By 1942, a semi-peripheral state, Germany, had conquered much of the core of the civilization. That effort was defeated by calling into that fray another peripheral state, and that would be the United States, and then yet another outside civilization, the Soviet society. And he said, it is not yet clear whether Western civilization will continue along the path marked by so many earlier civilizations, or whether it will be able to reorganize itself sufficiently to enter upon a new fourth age of expansion. If the former occurs, this age of conflict will undoubtedly continue with the fourfold characteristics of class struggle, war, irrationality, and declining progress. In this case, we shall undoubtedly get a universal empire in which the United States will rule most of Western civilization. To me, this makes sense as a position. Not if you think about what the United States is like right now, but what might be planned for the United States in the future. Now, remember that Alan would say that the war will come, that the United States, the America is being used for external conflicts, for conflicts abroad, for forever wars. So, I'm not necessarily positing that this is a continuation of that United States who is involved in endless conflict, but possibly a world order that uses the United States for expansion and not just conflict, for progress and not where we are now, where things in the United, where things have, where all of our manufacturing has been shipped abroad, where the dollar has been devalued. In other words, we're at a point where you cannot say the United States is the center of universal empire and expansion. I don't see that. But it could be that there is a plan that this fourth age, this fourth industrial revolution, does indeed spring from the United States. And one of the reasons why I posit that is because if you talk about diffusion, first of all, of material, of goods, of weaponry, weaponry would be the essential diffusion of the culture, that of the civilization that Quigley talks about, then yes, the United States has benefited from that kind of diffusion. But in the book, he makes the point that the key things, and we're talking about communication technology, automotive technology, none of that technology actually was invented or created or sprang from the United States. These were imported, and then the United States ran with it. They may have improved upon these technologies, but they were not the inventor of it. You see what I'm saying? That a possible continuation of what could be called Western civilization coming out of what we now think of as the United States. In my mind, this is very possible because of the way the United States was set up. And remember, Alan always pointed to the fact that these were the great experiments, the Soviet Union and the capitalist society of the United States. So we have here a culture in the United States that is the diffused culture of the core of Western civilization, with its own unique stamp by being what you might call the melting pot or the assimilation of very many different cultures. So we don't have a firm imprint here of ethnicity, even religion. There was initial vying between Catholicism, Protestantism, etc. So, and the United States is a very young culture, all things considered. So I could actually see a kind of wiping of the slate, and it's something new springing from right here. Now, where I think we are is cultural diffusion in Western civilization.
Okay, that's quite far ahead. That's gone into the second chapter or the second.
Yeah, see, I've got preface, and then I've got cultural evolution in civilizations, and we talked about that. Can man survive the rate of the age of expansion and the age of conflict? The types of civilization. So I feel that we covered that segment pretty well.
Yeah. So the details, Cretan civilization, the peripheral area, it's got the Aegean Islands, and then you've got classical and you've got Canaanite. Is that kind of thing, it's detail that we don't really need to go through? Because there's so much detail here, it's unreal.
I don't find that useful. I personally believe that that kind of detail is for the student. If they spark to it,
just to read,
then they can read that. They can think of, they can look further into Aryans and Cretans and Canaanite civilization. But to me,
my approach to this has been way too detailed. So I haven't formed a I haven't had the expectation of forming wider views on it yet. My idea was to cover some of the smaller things and then to give it a broader view.
I think so far in the introduction that you have succeeded in doing that. I think you really have. I mean, you've been able to leap impressively out into the time that we're living in,
Melissa.
and tie it in. So I've been in a few book clubs, and I don't think there's a right or a wrong way to approach it. What I'm hoping to do is that people will be engaged and they won't feel overwhelmed by detail or won't feel that, you know, I'm hoping that we can bring them the forest.
I see.
Without getting lost in the trees.
Okay, I'm going to concentrate on the forest in my future thinking on this book.
But if you've got another half hour in you, what I'd like to do is just let you take charge. And if you get into detail, that's fine. Why don't we just, because we said it's a work in progress, so why don't you go to the Kindle and make the points and do the reading that you prepared?
Easier said than done. How many hours have you got? You see, that's the thing.
Yeah.
I actually don't know where to start. I'm going to reformulate my approach. The book is so dense, and I find that the first parts actually all sort of lead up to Russia. So perhaps it's wiser to leave the earlier part of this reading up to the reader, because it gives you a very detailed history, which I suppose we could go through, and I will try and incorporate a better summary of it. But I think the beginning of this takes you to Russia, where things really get interesting. So I think perhaps I'd like to even start with Russia and then backtrack. I think that might be a good way of looking at this first reading.
I think that that's a good approach, Darren, because when I read all the way through it, I had, as you did, a more detailed approach and a more linear approach. But by the time I finished the Russia section and then went back and thought about his assertion that we're in, you know, in a struggle between two distinct, unique civilizations, it kind of reformulated my thinking. So I think perhaps when we dive into this tomorrow, let's start in Russia, like you said, and then work backwards.
It might make more sense, because the way that Quigley writes, he gives you the dessert right in the beginning, and he just keeps feeding you ice cream and cream as you go. And he's giving you all this background. So when you want to try and get to the point of it, I think you got to get to his conclusion, explain it, and then go back a little bit and fill in the reason why. Difficult.
You know, I shared in the very first recording that we made at the beginning of the month on the idea of book club. I shared this section right from the preface of the book, but I think it bears repeating. He said, you know, first of all, he said that he spent 20 years writing this book.
Yeah.
And he said, the result of all this, I hope, is an interpretation of the present as well as the immediate past and the near future, which is free from the accepted cliches, slogans, and self-justifications which mar so much of contemporary history. Then he said, and I think this is very key in the way that we approach the book club, much of my adult life has been devoted to training undergraduates in techniques of historical analysis, which will help them to free their understanding of history from the accepted categories and cognitive classifications of the society in which we live, since these, however necessary they may be for our processes of thought and for the concepts and symbols needed for us to communicate about reality, nevertheless do often serve as barriers which shield us from recognition of the underlying realities themselves. He concludes that section by saying, the present work is the result of such an attempt to look at the real situations which lie beneath the conceptual and verbal symbols. And I feel that it provides, as a consequence of this effort, a fresher, somewhat different, and I hope more satisfying explanation of how we arrived at this situation in which we now find ourselves. And I think that that is key, because what he is saying is that perhaps the linear, the microscopic approach is not necessarily the best way to try to figure it out.
Yeah, this book is incredible, because he talks about finance and what defines a feudal system and its economy, a commercial finance, industrial finance, the social systems that define it. And then he gets into, you know, the mercantile system, the merchant bankers, and how it turned into just pure finance.
Mm-hmm.
And you could actually spend a lot of time just discussing how the banks have evolved over time. That could be an entire discussion point for an hour or more, discussing how these banks create how they play with money and how they turn them into products and how they use it as leverage to control governments and how they've expanded their control. Just that topic is big.
It is. It's huge. I had the same thought when he was describing the banking system, and there is a tension that is hundreds of years old between deflationary and inflationary thinking. And again, this is not some kind of financial accident. This is actually different facets of banking at war with one another.
It's absolutely fascinating, and this is a topic I know that a lot of people out there, just in general, would be fascinated with how money is made, because a lot of people think that money is an actual real thing.
Mm-hmm.
It quickly points out immediately from the start that money is just debt, and mm-hmm. explains how it's debt and how goods move back and forth, how goods and money exchange, and how the people that run money understand it. And that's why you got to ask yourself when you read a book, who is meant to read this book? Who is the audience that Quigley was having in mind when he wrote all of this? And I think really it's the management team that runs the business project of Earth, particularly from the West's point of view. I've got a sneaky suspicion that the East is just a mirror reflection of the West, and it's used just as much as the West to set up a fourth age. The management team of the big club has its circles within circles, and you've got inner circles and outer circles, and it itself will have its semi-periphery and its periphery, a degreed system of understanding, different levels of confidence. So if I had to read this book and pretend that I am I'm part somewhere in this pyramid of control, where would I have to be in the hierarchy of knowledge to get a benefit from this book? And I'm thinking that, you know, students who were part of his class, they all went on to become people of high import in government and banking and the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an education for the people that go to Eton or to Georgetown University and all the rest. It's for the managerial class to become acquainted and to catch up, I think, with what they need to know. And then they go on to, I think, a higher education, and they specialize. So I see this as a foundational source of information for those people that are brought up and groomed. If you think of the young global leaders, you think of these people that are like the Young Mayors Global Network. The whole structure of managing the system, I think it's very important that Carol Quigley wrote this book, and I think it's meant for them.
I think so. I mean, remember that his students, yes, they went on to have positions in government and so forth, and also in foreign service and diplomacy. And those goals are not necessarily just diplomatic, but also tie in to the intelligence community. So he really is giving a view of history and the present that these people can use as they go out into the world.
Mm. Another thing that grabs me when I'm just going through his book is that he is an Anglophile of note. He almost worships at the feet of England or the Anglo sphere. I can just imagine that this book was charted as a directive from Chatham House, because it glorifies everything to do with the British Empire and England and how wonderful they were, and, you know, how backward Europe was. And Europe, it wasn't really that backward. So I just think that this book is for the class of foreign bureaucrats that are serving the interests of one particular side of the great work of global geopolitics. And I wouldn't be surprised if there is a Chinese version, a Chinese Carol Quigley, an equivalent somewhere out there that has written a similar book, but slanted towards the glorification of the Orthodox Russian culture, perhaps, and showing how backward Western civilization is. I could see it, because when I read this book, Tragedy and Hope, I know that it's technically correct, but really, think about it, it's very, very biased.
It is biased, and that is an excellent point, too, is the question, who did he write this for? And I think, remember that Alan was always fond of talking about Bertrand Russell and the idea that you would have a separate species, because this was not just breeding. This was the education that this class received. And so I think it is very important to have that in your mind as you approach it, is that this is not the kind of material that any of us got, regardless of what level we achieved at university or high school or whatever. We did not get this because this is not written for our class. This is written for the elite, the ruling class.
I think very much so. And I think it's even written for the younger ones coming up in bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a proper and serious catch-up for them to put them in perspective. Mm-hmm. But I think it's only for the West. This has got a very strong Western bias, and it smells strongly of the desires of someone from the Royal Institute of International Affairs, otherwise known as the Council of Foreign Relations. If they wanted to put their perspective, they really wanted to put their perspective into the mind of someone that's going to be used to further their interests. I really do think that the East has got its own version of this. I'd like to see if I can find anything.
Yeah, that's interesting. The other interesting thing about the point that you're making there is that the plates were destroyed by Macmillan. The popularity, and John Taylor Gatto makes that point quite succinctly and humorously in that long interview that he did with Richard, I believe his name is Grove, but which is, nobody expected that something so densely packed with usable information would be as readable and accessible as it is. Because, yes, there is a lot of information, but it is fascinating once you get into it. And the fact is, he did have access, a kind of access that was unique that no one else had ever been given, to the Council on Foreign Relations, and therefore the Royal Institute of International Affairs archives. And he quite simply put things across for his up-and-coming bureaucratic, diplomatic corps of young up-and-coming leaders. Yes. He made that available to us.
Yeah, the reason why I bring up the East versus the West on this is because he's still dividing the world into, it's going to end up being us versus Russia at the end. Will it be Western civilization that perseveres, or will Russian Orthodoxy take over? And I think he's playing a game here, because look at the world. Just look at the world from the 1950s. Look at the so-called Cold War, when we were all, or the West and the East was divided, and one was scared of the other. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people had drills at school where they would hide under their desk and put a mask on. And it was all hyped up in the movies, and the big bad Russian, and they're almost like a foreign species. You know, it was so badly, that's how I saw it. It was ridiculous to me. But look at the cooperation that's gone on above the heads of the average people. The average people that watch the news don't see the cooperation between the East and the West. It's complete. There's actually just one global governance. Mm-hmm. Further down below that level is a split between East and West to play the two together. Because during the height of the Cold War, you had the scientific community from every country on earth going to meet each other at global conventions. When it comes to, just take a look at the World Economic Forum.
Mm-hmm.
Look at who's participating. It's from everywhere. It's look at the UN. Look at how technology has spread between the East and the West. You take a look at some of the top United States fighter aircraft, and you look at some of the most advanced Russian and Chinese aircraft. They look identical.
Mm-hmm.
And they all sell weapons to each other, and they have international space stations. And I don't think there's any conflict going on up there. You know, when these enormous corporate businesses that are global have meetings in China, I don't think it matters a jolt to them where they happen to be. And then you take a look at something else. You look at the symbolic taking down of the Twin Towers in New York.
Mm-hmm.
But look at where they've replaced it. You know, Singapore. There's your Jackman Bowers. There's your Twin Towers right there. They've just moved to a different business location. And they're doing business with the Chinese as much as they are doing business with South Africa or anywhere else. So this thing where they're trying to put, you know, they're facing off the West and the East now with this militarism, and they've got the big bad bear of Putin picking on the poor Ukrainians. And what's happening in Israel right now is connected to that. So it looks like they are getting the plebeians to have one big final powwow, or if they're not going to have an actual powwow, they're going to raise the tensions to incredible levels and then probably throw in a cyber attack or who knows what else. But all I'm trying to get at is that there's a certain level of perception that the average person has who watches the news, and they look up and they see the clouds, you know, and they see voices on TV and they're talking down to them and they're giving them a perceived reality of the zeitgeist of who is the enemy of who. But if you just look at the people that are organizing this so-called fourth industrial revolution, you pierce through that cloud layer, there's no division. It's just banking and business agreements over resources and territory and who gets what, and opening up different areas for growth here and ports there. There is no division at the higher levels.
No, an interesting thing that came out of Davos this year, you know, Jamie Dimon took a lot of flack in the liberal press for saying that Donald Trump got a lot of things right. And because he got so much attention for that statement, what was overlooked was that several other bankers, mostly bankers, but there were some other people who weighed in on the Trump question, would Trump be reelected? And the thing that struck me about the bankers was they said, to a man, it doesn't matter who is the president of the United States.
Yes.
Business will go on as usual.
In the beginning of this book that people have read through, they'll see where the Rockefellers and the J.P. Morgans, they actually had a very, very hard time trying to hide the money that they were donating to both parties. And I think there's a little section in the book there where they were caught out. They were given some kind of name. I forget what it was now, like a nickname. I think they made it a little bit too blatant, but they support both parties equally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that reminds me, just before I forget, that there was a statement made by Quigley in this first section about exactly that, when he talks about how the Rothschilds tried to avert war and make peace, but they failed. They were overruled, basically. And that's just not true. That isn't true. They funded both sides of the war, as bankers always have funded both sides of the war. And whatever things, like if you see, you know, the Carnegie Endowment for Peace or whatever foundations that they have that purport to be trying to end a conflict, what you have above that is always hedging bets and funding both sides.
I think to summarize, what I take from this, from reading this book and from Alan's comments he's made in the past, the gist that I get from it is that the reason why it's important to read this book is that even though it is, you can tell that it's got a bias and that it's not really directed for the average person, it's still riddled with very important background information which the audience that this book is meant for needs to have. And so that information needs to have many aspects of truth and reliability to it. But what I want to emphasize is for those that are following along in the book club, we are not naive to believe that this book is God's honest truth and it's the only truth, and that everything on every page is, you know, we don't live our lives and guide our lives by this book. But it gives you a very good idea of how the people that manage the world think, how they perceive reality to some degree, and how, you know, they talk about leverage. You know, people with enough power have got long levers, and they can then dictate a certain amount of they've got a certain amount of weight to what they say and what they want, because they've got an economic power and leverage over powerful people that are less powerful below them.
Mm-hmm.
The book just really points out that it points out what the levers are, how the levers have become interlinked with other levers, and it shows you how the levers have a hierarchy. To some degree, it points out the direction that they want to take. It'll also point out these people don't make money just to get rich. That's another thing that you'll pick up from this book. It's not about money. There's a lot more to it than that. It's even more than power.
Do you want to elaborate on that? Or save that for another conversation? Yeah.
If I look at the other material that I've covered in my lifetime with regards to the sciences, for example, and you'll find it if you well read on particularly some of these futurists, you get involved in understanding nanotechnology and genetics. They're not messing around. They don't just study these things for fun. There's much higher reasons why these people mess with genomics. And if you take a look at certain big players who were very high in banking, you'll find that many of them were into the biological sciences,
mm-hmm.
or they were involved in very high positions in the Navy or the Army. I think Victor Rothschild was a scientist. Quite a few of them were.
Yes.
So they are involved in, you know, money gives you levers of power. Power then enables you to put your goals. It enables you to exercise them in the real world. And those goals, if you spend time getting to becoming acquainted, particularly with Alan's work, but you can go to the sources. And if you look, I mean, COVID was you got to ask yourself, they went through an incredible amount of effort to make sure that everyone got injected with something. That's not just for money, you know. If you think it's for money, you know,
right.
Just walk out the room and go watch TV. You don't go through that much kind of effort for just to make money. You look at how they want to control all the resources. You don't just control the resources for its own sake. You look at technocracy. You look at AI, how it all ties in with your learn about digital ID. You can see they have an overarching plan to manage the world and all its resources and all the life in it, to do with it as they please, to give themselves, I think, at the end of the day, the complete freedom of planet Earth, strictly for their own enjoyment, and everything else being designed and altered to suit their interests. And I think it boils down to that. And then they'll get their golden age, you know, where they're surrounded by perfect, obedient servants who do what they're told, who can build them their machines and take them onto whatever next step they've got, you know, maybe exploring the universe or whatever it is.
Yes, it's things to come. They're the toga-wearing class.
Yeah, I really do think that the more I've become acquainted with all of the stuff, we are sort of taught to mind our own business and not to think too much about it.
Mm-hmm.
But when banks in Europe put up signs on the tube or next to bus stops saying that your DNA will be your bank account number,
mm-hmm.
or something to that effect,
mm-hmm.
they don't just do that for fun. You know, these things are all leading to a situation where I think people could actually end up losing their consciousness.
Yes.
They could actually just become, and this might sound funny to people listening to this, but you could become a robot. The technology is there where people can be controlled to that degree, and I think it can be done from what I've been studying. You know, that the power that people think of as power now is just used as a tool to get to that level.
I think this is probably a good point for us to stop. I think that what we can do is dive into Russia. So start at the end of the section on our next recording and then work our way backwards. And hopefully we'll have a little bit better. I think there at the end we got some cooperation with the generator and the load shedding. But hopefully tomorrow when we try this again, we'll do good. But I enjoyed this little introduction, and I hope that other people got something from it. We'll be posting this on Telegram and on the website and other channels, and so I don't know if it'll be broken up into smaller segments, but we definitely are going to have the long form conversation and then perhaps little snippets or pieces of it at other places.
Thank you, Melissa. Sorry, I got a bit carried away at the end there.
Oh, no, that was... don't apologize.
We link the past up with the future. I think that's what is the important part about this whole thing.
Yes. I mean, Quigley said it himself in the preface. We are to understand where we are and where we're going. That is the real purpose of studying history.
Exactly.
We'll be putting this up as soon as possible, and then in the next day or two, look to Telegram and the other sites to hear the rest of this conversation. Meanwhile, I must say that the reading assignment for February is the section called The Buffer Fringe. And The Buffer Fringe, The Buffer Fringe is about another 100 pages, and that includes these subcategories, these subsections. The Near East to 1914, the British Imperial Crisis, Africa, Ireland, and India to 1926, and then the next large section is the Far East to World War I. So we're going to get we'll get into the 1930s and pre-World War II. He covers quite a bit in that section called The Buffer Fringe. So that is the February reading assignment. And then meanwhile, there will be at least one, possibly two more recordings from Darren and I on this first section. So I hope that you've gotten something from it. And thank you for joining in.